This is part two of our series on the special three mitzvos, which are associated with women uniquely, Challah, Neir Shabbos, and Yom Tov, and the laws of Nida. And we spoke a little bit about them last week as kind of a unit, and we saw there were, at the time, we didn't focus on any of them individually. We saw, oh, there's new babies here. Oh, this is so exciting. Her first year. Yeah, she's just a few weeks old, like literally.
Oh, okay. She's a lot of comfort, she's a girl.
Yes, exactly. It's true. If it had been a boy, we'd have big problems. Okay, Mazel Tov, welcome back. Anyway, so we saw that these are treated as a unit in the various sources. We did point out that, you know, we could not tell a lie. In the spirit of full transparency, the most famous source that associates these three mitzvos as a unit specifically speaks about unfortunately, that if a woman doesn't properly observe these mitzvos, she may suffer terrible consequences, dying in childbirth. And we mentioned that aside from the harshness of it on some level, but it's also just so striking because none of these are mitzvos that apply uniquely to women. Halachically, men are obligated in all three of these mitzvos. Challah, the daraisa challah we're describing, of course, has to do with the gift you would give to a Kohen in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, when the laws of Tum and Tahara were observed. If a Kohen was Tahor, if you were Tahor, you had to give the first bit of the dough that you had needed from any of your wheat crops, you had to give those, or any of the five grains, you had to give those to a Kohen. Well, a man has to do that also, not just if a woman's the one baking. We mentioned there are some families where the men are the challah bakers. Not in my family, I'm just saying. But obviously, if a husband is alone for Shabbos, as I was last week, who do you think lit the candles? I lit the candles. Men are obligated in candles as well. And, of course, the laws of Nida. If a couple does not observe those laws, so both men and women are deserving of punishment. It's an Aveira on both of those. And yet, despite that fact, it was clear from all the sources that we saw last week that women are given a certain priority and a certain responsibility, unique in all three of those. And we explored different rationales for why that might be. And, you know, we saw things which were a little bit more positive and uplifting, and we also saw, the first theory, which some suggested, which had to do with the fact that all three of these, on some level, are a tikkun for the chait of Chava, and that it's hard for us to understand that on a rational level, but all of womanhood is somehow, on some level, being metake in that chait. I did point out that concept, as hard as it is to understand, according to some of Farshim, actually applies to men as well. Some suggest that the mitzvah of Bris Milah is a tikkun for the sin of Adam. What does one have to do with the other? It's hard to understand on a rational level. What do I have to do with Adam all those years later? What am I being mitakein for? But there are such sources. There is such a concept. That was a little bit, you know, of a more negative way of looking at it. But it may be true. And then the more positive one, which we're going to, I think, amplify and emphasize more today, but with different sources in a different way, focused on these three being associated with the home. There wasn't as much discussion we saw last week, although we'll focus more on this a little bit today, about the laws of Nida. That seemed to be just more obvious why it would be a woman's primary responsibility. Certainly the checking and making sure that the things are going correctly. But even in the issues of Challah and Neiros, there were various mefarshim that suggested that since these are things that are done for the home, and again, especially historically, women were typically more at home, it became, so to speak, their responsibility. That is very much, in a nutshell, a five-minute summary of last week's hour-long shiur. So obviously, leaving out all the bells and the whistles and the various nuances. What I'd like to do, as we promised last week, what I'd like to do today is, first of all, to review some of the basics of all three of these categories, and then to suggest another way of looking at them as a unit, which, now that I think about it, really is, if you come to the table, you get a source sheet. If you sit back there, you don't get one. I can usually count on you, Mrs. Simons. Anyway, so another way of looking at this approach, which again we already mentioned in a more practical way last week about this idea of women being associated with the home, but I'd like to kind of revisit that in a much deeper, I think, spiritual, philosophical way, and with some interesting, I have to say, I don't want to boast, or I don't even want to humble boast. This was not intentional. but actually perfectly aligns with this week's parsha. But it wasn't. I did not plan that 2 weeks ago when we picked this series. So if I would be smarter, I would have. But I didn't. But it so happens as I was preparing this last night, I realized, wow, a number of sources that really are striking. That really, I think, it will reinforce the ultimate message I want to leave you with. That, as it so happens, come from this week's parsha. So without further ado, let's take each of these three mitzvos and just understand some of the basics of them. Let's begin with the laws of challah. So if you take a look at source number one, this is the Rambam describing the laws of challah. And the Rambam is going to tell us three important halachos, which are just important to know. If you remember maybe from high school or maybe from seminary, they might have called this yediot klaliot, right? Just some important things you need to know about challah. Number one, says the Rambam, again, all based on earlier sources. These are not controversial opinions of the Rambam. It was just an easier way for me to condense all the information into one source. Ein chayavin b'challah min haTorah. Eleb Eretz Yisrael Bilvad, Shin Amar V'Hayib Achalchem, Milechem Haaretz. When the Torah describes and introduces us to the mitzvah of separating challah, giving it to the Kohen, the Torah specifically mentions that this grain comes from Eretz Yisrael. And we learn from this, says the Rambam, that challah on a D'araisa level only occurs with grain that grew in Eretz Yisrael. Number one. Number two, says the Rambam, but even that is not always the case. When is that the case? Only if Bizman Shekol Yisrael Sham Shin Emar, as the Pasuk says, Bevo Achem, and we learn from that, Bias Kulchem Velo Bias Miktaschem. The Torah describes that when is this mitzvah triggered? Bevo Achem, when you will come into the land of Israel. Says the Rambam, again, based on earlier sources, it means when the entire Jewish people come into the land of Israel. And you have this fascinating phenomenon related to Shemitah also, but the original source of this is in Challah. You have an interplay between the objective Kedushas of Eretz Yisrael and the fact that somehow the Jewish people being in Eretz Yisrael contributes to and enhances that Kedusha. There is something diminished about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael when the Jews are not here, such that the same grain growing on the same land in the middle of, I don't know, the Beit Shan Valley, when the Jews are here, could be chayiv and challah on a Torah level, because that's the full Kedusha. But if the Jews weren't here and the challah grew there, somehow it somehow is missing and it only becomes a mitzvah midrabanan, and it's not challah on a Torah, on the Torah level. Fascinating idea. If we were only giving a shiur about challah or Shemitah or Truma or whatever, we'd explore that more. But just worth noting that nowadays, even in Eretz Yisrael, we assume challah is midrabanan. We do not have all of the Jewish people in the land of Israel yet. And even if all of a sudden there would be some mass aliyah, it's according to some, again, this is getting way down the rabbit hole, but I'll just mention it to you. Some say it's not even enough to have all of the Jewish people in Israel. We would need to know what Shevet we were from. You know, the land was divided up originally by Shvatim. I'm not sure some of us may end up in Beit Shemesh, some of us may not. Just think about that when you spend all that money on your house. I'm just saying. I assume you'd get fair market value if you had to sell it to move to wherever your Shevet is. I'm just saying. I'm a Levi. I don't have anything. You know. So anyway. So that some say even if we have, if all of a sudden be even a more mass aliyah now. So it could be it really needs Mashiach. It could be it's not just about population surveys. But be that as it may, two levels of challah. And last but not least, Rambam says on the last line, as you all know from your experience before you made aliyah, Mafrishin challah b'chutz laretz. Even though this is presented as a mitzvah that's connected to Eretz Yisrael, unlike others, it's not limited to Eretz Yisrael. If you have grain growing in Teaneck, well, I can probably know grain in Teaneck. I grew up in Ohio. There's a lot of grain there. I didn't grow up in Nebraska or not in Ukraine where there's even more grain. But there's grain in lots of places in Chutz Laretz. Midivrei Sofrim, the Chachamim, Midrabanan, rabbinically required you to separate Chal anyway. Kadesh lo tishtakach, Toras, Chalam Yisrael. Again, very, very interesting idea that somehow this is considered such a, there's a source sheet here on the table, there's such an important mitzvah that we, even though obviously the Torah anticipated, unfortunately, a very long galus, we didn't want that this halacha should be completely forgotten if the only times we ever had an opportunity to do this if we were living in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore this is one of those mitzvahs that we do even in Chutz Laretz. Okay, so that's why you know, growing up and even before you made Aliyah, people still would take challah. And as we mentioned last week, now that unfortunately everybody's tamei, you can't eat challah betuma, and therefore you couldn't give it to a kohen even if you wanted to. There would be no point. And therefore, the halacha is that we burn the challah. Okay, that's just the basics. Now, let's focus a little bit more on the meaning, the symbolism, the inner message of challah, and specifically how it might relate to women. And this comes up in source number two. Says the Rama, Nohagin, there is a minhag. And I'm sure some of the women, although not all in this women in this shir, have the minhag. Nohagin lalush kidei shir challah babayis, la'asos mehem lachmim livtso alayhem, v'shabes uba yom tov. This is the source, at least as it's quoted, for the idea of Jewish women specifically preparing challah for Shabbos and Yantif. And the Rama says, by the way, you should try, I know many women do have this practice, when you do it in a quantity big enough that you should be chayiv to separate challah against. This is not a halacha shir on the laws of challah. I don't want to get bogged down in the details of how much, and what's the volume, and how much flour. This is not our topic at all. But you all know that if you make a small amount, there's no mitzvah. If you have to make a bigger amount, there is. So it says that the Rama, a person should try, if you can, to go out of your way to bake enough, to knead enough dough, so that you can do the mitzvah of separating challah as you prepare for Shabbos and Yantif. But who, why, says the Rama, mikavod Shabbos v'yantif. This is a way of showing honor to Shabbos and to Yantif. Now, first of all, if I'm not mistaken, we mentioned this last week, that when we use the term colloquially challah, we mean that specific thing that, you know, you either make or you buy that's braided, but that's not necessarily, well, that's not what the Torah meant when he used the word challah, right? Challah could be something you made in the middle of the week, but it meant you had to give it to the kohen. There's some source sheets on the table. I think you might get the last one or two there. Anyway, so I think, if I'm not mistaken, I don't know if I could prove this anywhere, I don't know if anyone could prove it, but I think that's exactly pretty much what happened. In other words, initially, at some point in history, challah just meant the thing you gave to the kohen. But I think over time, and this is what the Rama is codifying, but not because of the Rama, I think it probably predates him, over time, it became a thing that predominantly, when did women do this? When did anyone do this? When they were preparing for Shabbos, and then they maybe made enough for the whole week or whatever. So it eventually became associated. When did you do enough that you could give the mitzvah of challah when you were making what we now call challah? I know somebody, and it's funny, it sounds very weird to us nowadays, but I know a family, they grew up, they refer to, at the Shabbos table, can you pass the bread? And those of us who've been at the table with them, it hits us a little weird. It's not bread, it's challah. But they're not wrong. In fact, I think historically that is probably what happened. For many, it used to be bread, and then, but because it became associated with the thing that we bake so that we can give the challah to the Kohen, then it became, for most Jews for many hundreds of years, now we call it challah. Anyway, it all started with this idea which the Rama is bringing down. Now, why? Why is this, of all things that you could do, and there are many things we do also, that we do in honor of Shabbos, that maybe we do, if we can, as an Erev Shabbos, why is challah one of those? So the Rama says enigmatically this honors Shabbos. But how? In what way? What exactly are we talking about? So I didn't put it on the sheet, but the Mishnah Brura gives us kind of a technical answer and brings us back to the topic that we mentioned last week, that these mitzvos, according to one theory, are all associated with the sin of Chava and Adam, and that basically by her eating from the Eitz Hadas and then convincing her husband to do the same, she brought death into the world. Adam and Chava, by extension, would have lived forever, and death got brought into the world. As some of you may remember from your previous learning, the whole story with Adam and Chava and the Eitz Hadas, it all happened on the same day when they were born. The Gemara actually describes, like, I don't think, I can't remember exactly, is it 10 hours or 12 hours of creation, right? Everything was happening pretty fast. Then Hashem had there was no traffic, there was no holdup. Everything happened very, very quickly. So not only did the sin happen, but that whole idea of the death being introduced to the world and Adam being born and everything, it all happened on Erev Shabbos, right? When was the sixth day of creation is when Adam was created. So Mishnah Brura says, because the whole problem that this is coming to be mitakein happened on an Erev Shabbos, so therefore the minhag is to do this on Erev Shabbos, since anyway you're doing this as a tikkun. Okay, could be true. And it's fine. It's not. I don't think I wouldn't call it inspiring, but it's a technical possibility. It could be that's true. However, I saw suggested perhaps a second theory, which I think is also very, very, very powerful, and I think, you know, a little bit more uplifting and authentic, but also more inspiring. Take a look at source number three. This is, again, I'm taking it out of context. The context of what the Navi Yechezkel is talking about here is not important for us, but here you see the Navi Yechezkel refers to challah specifically, how the first part of your dough you're giving to the Kohen, and says the Navi, why do we do this? Lahaniach bracha el beitecha. By giving the challah to the Kohen, that brings blessing to your house. Now, why? What about challah brings bracha? So perhaps the explanation is from the Sefer HaChinuch in source number 4. And this is really gets to the heart of, if you just, you know, if you tuned out for the last 10 minutes and you just want to know, you know, inquiring minds want to know, what is the message of challah? What is the philosophy of challah? What's the tam ha-mitzvah? Why is there a mitzvah, you know, which we can sort of do now, but originally was intended to be given as a gift to the Kohen, specifically from our dough? What are we trying to do by giving this to the Kohen? What's the meaning behind this? So it says the Sefer HaChinuch. Some of you are familiar, if you've studied Sefer HaChinuch in the past, you know the Sefer HaChinuch counted all 613 mitzvos, in his opinion. And one of the things that's unique about Sefer HaChinuch is at the end of his presentation about the halachos and the sources, he always concludes with what he thinks is the philosophy behind the mitzvah, the tam ha-mitzvah, or what he calls the shoresh ha-mitzvah. And here says the Sefer HaChinuch, source number 4, what's the purpose of challah? We have to realize, again, it's less true nowadays, although it may still be true to some extent, but in the Western world it's less true now, but certainly for most of human history, what was true? Lefi, source number 4, shechiyoso shel adam bimizonos, right? Bread is the staff of life, right? Most people primarily lived and were sustained off of bread. Rov ha'olam yichyu b'lechem, right? That's what sustained most of the world. And therefore, since that was the staple, the main food that people eat, ratza ha'makom l'zchuteinu l'zakoteinu b'mitzvah t'midis b'lachmeinu, Hashem, so to speak, wanted to give us the opportunities, offering us a chance to take advantage of with something that would be consistent, right? How often do you, you know, harvest, you know, whatever it is, you know, the other things that you might give truma and maaser for, right? That'd be once a year. Maybe not even everyone's a farmer, but certainly even in agricultural society, those things are more infrequent. But bread, and again, it's not just even if at certain months of the year, that's when you harvest all the wheat. Let's say we're talking about wheat bread, but it doesn't go bad, right? You keep it in the silo or whatever, and then if every Erev Shabbos or whatever, every few weeks, you're grinding that, turning it into flour, and making bread. That's a consistent thing, much more consistent than when you eat the figs or when you eat the pomegranates, right? It's much more consistent, and therefore, dafkin, the thing that's going to be the most consistent and the most important staple of your physical diet, Hashem said, here's a mitzvah. Kedesh tanuach bracha bo aydeh ha-mitzvah v'nekabo zchus b'nafshenu. Here, infuse that thing, the thing that is the staple of your physical life, infuse that with spirituality. And here I think the last phrase is really the most beautiful. V'nimtz'et, what emerges from here? Ha'isa, this dough, isa means the dough, mazon laguf, the mazon lanefesh. Right? It's not just something that physically sustains us, it's also something that's satiating our soul. It's soul food, not just physical sustenance. Mazon laguf, u'mazon lanefesh. By creating a mitzvah, in challah, in our bread, that is infusing the most physical staple of our lives, the thing which we could not, for most of history, do living without, and giving that spirituality. Now, if you take a step back, again, something which we'll focus on when we get back to the end of the shiur, yet again, we see something that now is not just this technical thing, I give to the Kohen, and again, now it seems even, you know, harder to appreciate because we're just putting it in the oven and burning it. But what's the point? By taking it out and doing that, that's something that's very, very powerful. It adds spirituality to this most physical thing. I would add, and I think this is also something that really dovetails beautifully with Shabbos, right? When it comes to Shabbos, right, basically we are working all week, and then we, so to speak, take a break to, so to speak, trust Hashem. Similarly, to some extent here, when we have our physical thing, right? You worked all this time, you're the farmer, you harvest. Again, it's a little bit harder for us to appreciate when we just go to the store and buy the flour. But if you think about what this meant in the time of the Tanakh, right? You're the one who worked, you're the one who harvested, you planted, et cetera, et cetera, to get all this grain. And it's reshit arisoseichem. Before you even benefited, the first thing, even before you can benefit, you give it to the Kohen, right? This is how, right, we're willing to trust Hashem, and so we give over from even the first things, even before we've enjoyed the benefits of our own labor, right? There's something profoundly, not only altruistic, but profoundly spiritual in that. And the fact that that is taking place, as the Sefer HaChinuch, in the context of the thing that is the most consistent and important staple of our physical sustenance, really fuses the physical and the spiritual and enhances the physical. Okay, there's more to say, but Ad Kan HaKafa Aleph, that is chapter 1, that is challah. Let's go on to the next topic, which was Nida. or at least for today's shiur, we're doing in this order. So if you take a look at source number 5, some of you may be familiar, some of your husbands are learning with me every Sunday, or we have the Smichas Chavar shiur. I'm giving shiurim tremendous shiur on Hilchos Nida, and we were discussing some of these halachos and some of these psukim just recently. But as you may know, the descriptions of the Torah of Nida, the descriptions of Nida in the Torah are somewhat enigmatic and hard to read, and certainly you don't necessarily... doesn't follow when you just read a Chumash, even Chumash and Rashi, let alone just Chumash, to what we do nowadays. But it's important to start with, I think, an idea. Again, I want to focus now not on Hilchos Nida. There's been discussions about whether we should have either a mini-series or something about Hilchos Nida in the shul for women, and I'm completely open and sensitive to someone or people telling me that maybe I'm not the right person for that shiur, and there's a woman in this shul who may be qualified to give such a shiur, and there may be other people outside the community that we could bring in. So those who are interested should be in touch with me or maybe Alyssa to give me some feedback about that. But even last year, there was a little bit of a discussion. This summer, someone mentioned it to me. But anyway, in the meantime, I am teaching a regular shiur for men now on the topic. But the pasuk that describes the concept of Nida in the Torah in source number 5 describes here, if you take a look, as Shivas Yamim Tiem Nidasa. Now, the 7 days, and I want to focus on the 7 for a moment, that a woman in the time of the Beis Mikdash, in the time of the Torah, she was Tamei when she sees blood. So this is not necessarily talking about the Shiva Nikiyim. We'll get to in a second. That comes from a different pasuk, the 7 clean days. This is talking about a 7-day period. And basically, as some of you may know, this is very different than the laws of Nida nowadays, but Mida Araisa, at a certain time of the month, if a woman would see blood, she would automatically be Tamei for 7 days, whether she saw once, twice, or for all 7 days. But once you saw it, if it was at that time of the month, then there's a 7-day tuma period. That night she would go to the mikvah, and then she would be Tahor. Tahor to her husband, Tahor to touch, you know, things that are Tahor and Kadosh in those days, Nida wasn't just about intimacy with husband and wife. It was the whole world of purity and impurity. Tum and Tara was the way they lived. That's the 7-day time period. Now, the number 7, of course, also comes up when it comes to not only when a woman is Tamei, but how she becomes Tahor. And if you just skip for a second down to source number 8, a pasuk which we'll get back to, but here, this is the source in the Torah for the idea of Shivas Yamim, that she counts, the idea of Safra, Allah Shivas Yamim, the counting of the 7 clean days. Now, in the Torah, this is describing something which is not exactly what we do now. The Torah is describing, again, this is maybe a review for some of you who maybe learned it more in depth, or some of you who just learned it even in anticipation of your wedding. But in the Torah's conception, there were two concepts. There's what's called Nida, but then there's also something that was called Zava. They both describe the phenomenon of a woman becoming Tamei from menstrual blood, but Nida and Zava. And Zava was at a different period of the month. And there, the halachos were, in the time of the Torah, that if in that time of the month, a woman would see for 3 straight days, she had a super tumah called Zava Gedola, and then she would have to count 7 clean days before she could go to the mikvah. That's the only idea in the Torah where 7 clean days come in. Only if a woman saw 3 days in a row at a certain time of the month called Zava, which is not the same time of the month called Nida. As some of you may recall or know, somehow there's this huge leap at some point in history, already in the time of the Gemara, from that to what we all know of the laws of Nida, because as the Gemara tells us, Benos Yisrael, Hichmiro al-Atzman. At some point in history, I don't know if anyone knows exactly when, but this is already quoted in the Gemara, the women, the rabbis codified it, but it says from the Gemara that this came from the women themselves, that they decided that any time a woman would see blood that could be identified as from her flow, from her monthly period, that she would, even if it wasn't exactly at that time of the month, and it wasn't this many days, she would assume the most machmir thing, which would have been requiring not only the cessation of bleeding, but then the waiting of 7 clean days. Where does the 5 days before that 7 come in? That's not our topic at all now. Okay, but that was another chumrah that came on. And that's where we get to the basic structure of more or less 12 days a month. You know, obviously we all know that it can be sometimes more. But, okay, so that's just a quick review. Just you should appreciate the pasuk. But in that world of Nida, the number 7 comes up. It's a big number. Both in the Tumah perspective in the first pasuk, and in the becoming clean, or Tahor, maybe is a better way of putting it, in the second pasuk. What is the symbolism of 7? And perhaps what does this teach us about the laws of Taharas HaMishpacha in general? So take a look at source number 6. This is a famous teaching of the Maharal in Netzach Yisrael. Some of you may have learned this inside, some of you may have just heard this idea, because it's become very influential from the Maharal. Says the Maharal, 7 symbolizes Shleimus Shel HaOlam Hazeh. Ein Rak Ad Zayin. The unit of 7, which we have obviously a lot in Judaism, 7 symbolizes, says the Maharal of Prague, 7 symbolizes this world, natural things. Ki HaOlam Hazeh, Hu Olam HaTeva, right? This world is a natural world. Shenivra b'shivas yimei habereishis. So, since it was created in 7 days, 7 symbolizes everything that is teva, natural, scientific, intuitive, rational. All of that is in units of 7. 8, says the Maharal, is me'al hateva, supernatural, above and beyond nature, is symbolized. We're all talking about symbolism here. Is 8, right? That's what the baby's bris is, where he's going beyond. He was naturally born uncircumcised. That's 7. He enters a higher level on the 8th day. 8, says the Maharal, is me'al hateva. Okay, but where our purpose is now is 7, says the Maharal, 7 symbolizes creation. This world was created in 7 days, and therefore all of creation is symbolized in natural units of 7. So if that's the case, I don't think it's such a leap to suggest that perhaps what the laws of Nida and Taharas HaMishpacha are communicating, I would say to anyone, but certainly specifically to women, is that the process of becoming a Nida and then becoming Tahor and emerging from that status is not just technically a process of I was Tameh, now I'm Tahor. In a modern context, I was usher to be with my husband, now I'm permitted, but it's actually, all those things are true, but it's also a process of recreation. Each month you're becoming somebody new, you're being reborn. That 7, that's why it's not a random thing, says the Maharal, that it's 7. That each month is a process of some part of you being discarded, and then a new person emerging from the mikvah. I'm not even getting into the symbolism of the waters and the mikvah, although this obviously fits with those ideas as well. But just the process of 7, right? You become Tameh in a unit of 7 from the Torah perspective, and you become Tahor, you re-emerge. And again, we all understand, you know, with the basics of biology, right? Where is that blood coming from? It was the loss of a potential life. Right? It's an unfertilized egg. That's where it's being in the endometrial lining. I mean, we're not going to go back through ninth grade biology now. But there was a life. Something is being discarded, and new life. No, it's not just the new life, you know, of that egg follicle. It's the woman herself is becoming reborn. I'm not assuming that every single time a woman's going through sometimes the frustrating process of doing this on a monthly basis, you're thinking of all this. Just like if I gave you a beautiful Torah about the meaning of shofar, doesn't mean that people are thinking about that then. Or the laws of kashrus, I could give you lots of beautiful Torah, doesn't mean that people are thinking about that when they're shechting the animal. And I would hope not, because then they might make a mistake. The point is, I understand that life and mitzvos, and including this mitzvah, can be challenging for a couple, it can be challenging for women specifically. None of this is to shortcut that. We're just kind of giving short points here. But I think it's something worth thinking about based on this Maharal, that it's not a coincidence that there's these units of 7, and that I think on some very meaningful and deep level, again, I speak as the one person who this doesn't involve in the room directly, I think that might be part of the message of Nida. A second message, specifically as it relates, again, that idea would be true even if we were just describing Nida in the context of Tumah and Tahara, you know, ritual, purity and impurity. But Nida always had, and obviously in our day and age, it only has ramifications for marital life. What's the message? What's the Torah trying to accomplish by involving us in this in these laws? So, as you know, there are many famous books. Your grandfather wrote a very famous book, Rabbi Lam, on this topic, The Hedge of Roses, and there's other famous books about the laws of Nida. And perhaps the most famous source, which many, you know, modern scholars in particular do talk about, but it comes from a Gemara, is source number 7. And again, here also, again, there's probably a lot to talk about, maybe even stuff that you prefer talking about, not with a man in the room, I don't know. But either way, we'll just mention for a few moments, I think it's a meaningful idea, and even if it's not always the case, but I think it is what to strive for, and I think most of us will recognize a lot of truth in this. And that is the famous Gemara in source number 7, Rabbi Meir Omer, Neima Amra Torah Nida L'Shiva. Again, forget the focus on 7 here, that's not the point of the Gemara, but why is it that we have this extended period every month where a woman is Tameh, and in some cases we add another extended period that takes her to becoming Tahor, says the Gemara, Evnei Sharagilba V'Ketzba. Because if a husband and wife were always and constantly permitted to each other, I would say the best way to put it would be the passion would grow stale. You would lose the passion. The relationship would be stale. Amra Torah, Tehei Tameya Shiva Yamim. Therefore, the Torah says, take a break. Be separated, husband and wife, for 7 days. Kadesh Tehei Chaviva Al Ba'ala Eis Kenisa L'Chuppah. So that when she reemerges in a state of being permitted to be with her husband after the chuppah, after the mikvah, it will be as hopefully romantic, passionate, intimate, etc., as the first time that they were together. Which is another way of saying an idea. Again, I think Rabbi Lam wrote his whole book based on this idea, but basically saying that the idea of nida is at least aspirationally trying to create a monthly honeymoon. The idea of something unique and special, and we know this from every area of life, not only from this part of our lives, which is that, you know, repetition over time without any break creates, boredom and being stale. Now, it's obvious, and again, I don't want to spend too much time on this now, that there can be times in which it is not re-injecting the marriage with passion, but just difficult and hard and lonely. And that can happen even in a regular month, given particular challenges in a couple's life. Or it could be, and obviously as a rabbi, when I get shilas, this is not uncommon at all, unfortunately. I remember when I first got married, or it was even before I became a rav and had to deal with this from that perspective, even when I first got married, so I did my chassan classes with Rabbi Neuberger. I guess if you were a certain age, at least in the YU world, the men went with Rabbi Neuberger and the women studied with Rebbetzin Neuberger. And I remember Rabbi Neuberger mentioning to us at the time, I didn't appreciate it, how true it was, he said, certain women could go their whole married lives and have almost no shilas. When they're getting the period, they're getting the period. When they're doing their bedikos, they do the bedikos. There's no spotting, there's no standing. It's just, you know, it could be once or twice in years with even a shila. And then there are other women who almost every month have a shiloh. Right? That's a hormonal, biological reality. It wasn't a judgmental statement. It was just a fact. Like, you don't know, before you get married, which one you're going to be. Right? I can tell you, as a rav, I've seen this dramatically. Again, I can't infer from the people who don't ask me shilohs why they're not asking me shilohs. Could it be that there's no spotting or staining at all, or they just don't have shilohs? That's a separate discussion. But I can tell you that there are certain women who, with very strong regularity, have shilohs. Yeah, there are some who just every now and then have a shayla, but there's definitely certain women, and there are some who have a really, really hard time getting to the mikvah. And it's obvious that this is an incredible, incredible stress on the marriage. So when you have those kind of situations, you don't see this beauty of this Gemara, you know, with the harps and the music and the honeymoon and the chocolates, and right? Obviously, this halacha can also be challenging. It's not always beautiful. I get that. I'm not trying to sweep that under the rug. I'm just, you know, for a little credit, give me a little credibility. But as a ideal, which hopefully many of us, if not all of us, at least sometimes, if not always, can experience, I think that this resonates very, very true. Moreover, what I think that this encourages, similar, very similar, I would argue, to the challah concept, was that fusion between physical and spiritual. And just like, you know, on the Shabbos or other things, there's a certain balance between physical and emotional, or physical and spiritual. We saw with the working and the farmer, and then bringing the mitzvah and putting that into my challah, into my bread, the staff of life becomes spiritual, not just physical sustenance. Here also, we have a certain balance, especially in this Gemara, between a couple's emotional connection and their physical connection. And a good marriage has to have both, right? One, you know, if it's just emotional, you could be friends, but you're not married in a healthy way. And if it's just physical, that's certainly something else, but not a good marriage. Right, so you need to have both, and there is the laws of Nida on some level, as is being described here, are there to create that. And last point on this, something which we mentioned outside last week, but I'll just emphasize it now with the sources, and sources number 8 and 9, and that is that if that is this vision of the laws of Nida, again, try to remember this when it's difficult. Try to remember this when you're not sure at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on a winter. Did I remember to do the bdika? Did I not? Is it too late? Can I get to the rabbi to ask him the shaila? I'm away at my in-laws for Shabbos and I have a Friday night mikvah. Like all those hard parts of the halakha, okay? And I'm probably only describing like a fraction of them. But there is this beautiful goal, which hopefully is as often as possible we can connect with. If there's that beautiful goal as a spiritual person individually, to enhance my marriage on every level, it can't be, I don't think, ignored that the responsibility for that and the priority of that is given to the woman to create. And that is not just a hashkafic point, that's a halachic point, which we mentioned last week, but we'll reiterate it inside here. That's the first part of that pasuk in source number 8, where the Torah says, v'safra la. Right? It's very much in the feminine. Who counts? Who's in charge of making sure that she's tahor? Right? Not her husband. Her husband's not in charge. Her husband doesn't get to second guess her. Her husband's not the one who's checking. She's the one who checks, and she's the one who's supposed to count. And the Gemara learns from this in source number 9 that halachically, mida araisa, a woman is the one who's trusted. And therefore, not only, well, she'll say she knows herself, the husband who has no way of knowing. Again, it's not appropriate. I was strong, again, unless there's a question, and again, in certain couples, maybe this is something that you would share, but the idea of a husband constantly second-guessing or telling his wife, I want to see it to make sure it's okay, that is not appropriate halachically. And it is certainly not good marriage advice. That should not be happening. The halacha is a husband supposed to trust his wife about this. Now, if she says, I'm not sure, do you want to take a look? If she thinks he knows what he's looking at, okay, that's one thing. But probably the real thing is if you're not sure about something, to ask the rabbi. But it should not be in any way the husband doesn't trust his wife. Again, if he wants to help remind her, you know, again, sometimes the husband thinks he's doing a favor and it's appreciated, and sometimes it wasn't appreciated. But for the most part, it should never be more than that, because the Torah and the Gemara, the Halacha, put the trust in women for that. As the Gemara here in source number says, Minayin l'nida shesoferes la'atzma, which in the context means, how do we know that she's the one who's trusted? Not only that she's trusted for herself, that a husband has a halachic right to trust her. He might say, how do I know? And if she's not tahor, maybe I'm getting involved in my own iser kares. And the answer is no, halachically, he trusts her. Shinamar, v'safra la, shivas yamim, la latma. She is the one who's believed, and this is under. So that's true on a technical, a halachic level. But again, I think the deeper message to me is that this balance that we're creating between not only physical and spiritual, but in the married life, between physical and emotional, that sacred framework that allows, hopefully, a full marriage to blossom, that is given to the woman to create that structure to help create. Okay, number 3. We'll do this a little more quickly so that we can get to the last part of the shiur, and that is the laws of Shabbos candles. So this is especially what we're going to do quickly because last year, we gave a 2-part series, very in-depth. I think we probably did close to 40 sources, which is not even enough, but we did a very in-depth 2-part series on the laws and the halachos of Shabbos candles. But just to review very, very quickly, some basics. In the sources, there are 3 different theories for where the mitzvah, or why the mitzvah of Shabbos candles. What's the purpose of Shabbos candles? And there are 3 different concepts, and basically we have Makorot that tie Shabbos candles to all 3, and the truth is it's probably not a contradiction. They're probably all true. Number 1 of those 3, says the Rambam at source number 10, if you turn over your sheet, we light candles for Oneg Shabbos, right? Everything is better with a little light, and certainly the Shabbos experience, and specifically even the food, will taste better, which we know as an actual fact, right? If somebody, you know, somebody who's blind does not taste the food the same way, that's why we care about presentation of the food, right? It enhances the experience. That's Oneg Shabbos. Number 2, the Rambam says in the next source, there's also an inyan of Kavod Shabbos, right? And here, I'll channel what the Vilna Gaon, and after the Vilna Gaon, other Achronim understood this Rambam is saying. If you see the context there, says the Rambam, V'hiner daluk, shochan aruch, umita mutzad, all these things should be done before Shabbos. Tzarech l'takein beiso, mibaod yom, mipnei kavod Shabbos. What's the difference between kavod and oneg? Kavod are the things we do before Shabbos to prepare for Shabbos. Right? If you had an important guest coming, important could be somebody famous, or it could be your parents or your in-laws, but somebody's coming for Shabbos, right? When you know, right, you clean up a little bit better. I could tell you, when my mother-in-law's coming, I definitely clean up a little. Okay, fine, not really. But when my parents are coming, then the house has to be really, really clean, right? And the bed, double check the bed and make sure everything was set up in the guest room, right? So when you have a bet, a chash of a guest coming, right, you prepare. So the things we do before Shabbos for the Shabbos queen, that shows the honor of Shabbos. So says the Rambam, one of the things that we do, it's true, we light candles before it's dark, because technically if we would light them afterwards, we'd be Michal Shabbos. So that's also another reason. That's the real reason we can't light on Shabbos. But says the Rambam, by doing so, before Shabbos, that is an act of kavod Shabbos, the same way preparing the house in general is. And the third thing is, in source number 12, the Gemara says something very interesting. Maybe you may have heard this before. Let's say Nebuch. A person had so little money, they only have enough money either for Kiddush wine or for candles. Or on Chanukah, Shabbos Chanukah, they can't get candles for Chanukah and for Shabbos. So poor. Which one comes first? So in all these cases, says the Gemara, source number 12, Shabbos candles always has priority. Now this is particularly striking when it comes to Kiddush, because Kiddush is a concept midaraisa. And yet, says the Gemara, why? Source number 12, Ner Beso Adif, Shabbos candles always come first, Mishum Shalom Beso. There's a third idea. Again, some achronim say, no, this is really what Oneg and Shalom Bayis might be the same. But here it's used a different term, at least, is Shalom Bayis. Now, it's important to note that the candles and the term Shalom Bayis here is not what they meant during all those Sheva Bracha Torahs. And Devarei Torah, and you should have Shalom Bayis, and Bilbat Nis, and Neman, all that stuff. That's nice. You should all have that, and we should all have that halavai. But that's not what Shalom Bayis means in this context. Rashi says, what does it mean, Shalom Bayis? Source number 13. Something much more prosaic, but not so prosaic to be meaningless. Number one is, right, if there's no lights and you stub your toe, it's going to hurt, you're going to be in a bad mood, you're not going to enjoy Shabbos. Right, it's not enjoyable to be, right, I think it was not this past summer, but the summer before, but there was a flurry of power outages in the neighborhood. Welcome to the New Olim. They call it a brownout. And it always happened in the summer on Erev Shabbos, right? Because everyone's home, air conditionings are blaring because Beit Shemesh is Beit Shemesh. It's very hot in the summer, and everyone's cooking, right? And it always would happen, you know, an hour and a half, 2 hours before Shabbos. Most of the time, you were stressed, and then it came back on. But there was at least one Friday night where I'm still hot, just, you know, thinking about how uncomfortable that Friday night was. And you were basically, you know, you didn't really care about how dark it was because you were so hot. Like, just you had no space mentally to be miserable about anything else because the heat was so oppressive. But it was horrible to be in the dark also, right? It was horrible. People had the candles and everything. You felt like you were, you know, went back in time. So number one is just on a physical level, it's miserable to be in the dark. But also, we also understand it's on an emotional level, right? How good do you think the conversation is going to be if you're sitting in the dark, right? Those magical moments, hopefully, which we all strive for on Friday nights or whatever, you know, husband and wife have some time to talk maybe during a busy week, they didn't have time, catching up with your kids, how was their week, all that stuff, right? You can't do it if there's no light. So says Rashi, you're losing something. That's Shalom Bayis, right? Now, you could also add, which we mentioned last week, you know, the Psukim Ki Ner Mitzvah V'Torah, or Ner Hashem Nishmas Adam, right? The candles symbolize the soul, candles symbolize Torah, so it's the physical, there's the emotional, and there's even the spiritual idea. So Shabbos candles really have a lot of different, you know, again, it's a multitasker, which I guess is maybe another reason why women light Shabbos candles, because they know how to multitask. Men obviously don't. There's so many different things that are going on with Shabbos candles. They're for kavod, they're for oneg, they're for the Shalom Bayis, and all those things, those are the deeper messages of Shabbos candles. Now, again, we're going to move on, because I want to get to the last part of the shiur. I also think if I would have asked, you know, at the outset, you know, of the three, which is the easiest to, so to speak, connect to on a spiritual level, I assume most people would have said Shabbos candles. Right? The idea of finding spirituality, although in recent years, challah has become this, like, the cool mitzvah. You know, and that's, you know, everyone's into challah. But I don't think that was always the case. I don't think it's obvious. It may be true, as we saw from the Sefer Chinuch, there's something very meaningful about challah, but I don't think it's obvious. The laws of Nida, again, to some people, maybe it's intuitive that there's something meaningful behind them, but for a lot of people, it's just an obligation or a burden or something that's difficult that they have to contend with. But again, what we've tried to show is that in all three of these, in addition to the basic halachos, there is a certain deeper message that all three of them have, and there's a certain deeper message that all three of them share, I would say, about infusing and combining the physical and the spiritual. Okay, in the 15 minutes that we have left, I want to turn to the last part of the shiur, and that is now that we kind of did a little bit of, I wouldn't say a deep dive, but we did a shallow dive into all three of them. Now let's return to looking at them as a unit. And we saw a few sources last week that described them as a unit, but now I'd like to see some other sources, including, as it so happens, as I mentioned at the outset, a number of sources from this coming week's Parsha, Parshas Chayesara, that describe the three of them as a unit in a way that I think, to some extent, it connects to one of the things we talked about last week, but certainly I think in a much deeper way and maybe even in a new way. So take a look at source number 14. Here's an example of one of the Gemaras that I don't think we mentioned this last week, that describes these three mitzvos, or not explicitly, but I think may allude to these mitzvos as a unit. This is a Gemara that's describing about when, again, the assumption was, and it's still true predominantly, but historically for sure, who goes to shul, and certainly who goes to shul Friday night? Men. So the assumption, this is coming from the perspective of a man, if he's coming home Friday night, kishabala beso, when he comes home, what does he find? Sometimes, unfortunately, you find chaos. Right? That's not good. It's not good for a marriage, but it's also not good spiritually. Says the Gemara, if you find everything in place, it's a very good thing. If a person comes home and he finds ner daluk, the candles are lit, shulchan aruch, the table has been set. Now here is the more vague one, mitato motzat, the beds were made. So it could be that on a simple level it just means the house was clean, things are neat. But I would suggest that it may mean in this context something different. But this was first finished the Gemara, then we'll go back. So says the Gemara, if you come home and you see everything is good, the malach, this is the Gemara, the context of the Gemara there is that when a man comes home from shul, he's accompanied by two malachim. I never saw them, and I have a very short walk now, so maybe if I had a longer walk I could feel them, I'm not sure. But if I lived in Neve Shamir, maybe then I would be able to feel the malach. But they don't come on Friday nights, those guys. Anyway, so says the Gemara, the malach comes in and he sees how beautiful this house is, and he says, Yihi rotzon shetehei l'shabbos acheres kach. He gives you a bracha. Everything's beautiful and ready for Shabbos this week. It should be beautiful and ready for Shabbos the same way next week. And unfortunately, the opposite would be true if the house was in chaos. So this idea of having everything ready and beautiful and presentable is an idea that's quoted in this Gemara. Okay, that's fine. And again, the three things here are very concrete physical items. You could easily understand this, perhaps even on an emotional or marriage level, that this is a nice thing. Fine, fine, fine. But it seems to me that it's not a coincidence that these three very strongly correspond, if not even more than that, to the three mitzvos that we're describing, right? Ner daluk, right? Obviously, that's the Shabbos candles. That's the most obvious. But Shulchan Aruch, again, it's not limited to, but I think on a deeper level, it certainly corresponds to challah, right? The food, everything is ready. And mitato mutzat, it might just mean that, the beds were made, so to speak, meaning the house is clean. But there's a lot of ways of saying the house was clean or everything's put in order, right? Why dafka beds? So it could be that this is an allusion as well to the laws of Nida. And the idea, again, now, obviously not every Friday night is a woman going to be tahor anyway. That's by definition true. But the idea that a woman has been responsible for these three, this is what brings bracha to the house. Right? That if these three things are being taken care of, and we know it's the woman's responsibility to take care of them, that's what brings the bracha from the malach. Interesting. Now, that impression, I think, is confirmed by a famous medrash in this week's parsha, quoted by Rashi. Right? You'll recall, right, the pasuk, there's a lot of big things in this week's parsha. It starts off tragically, Sarah dies, and Avram realizes, you know what, if Sarah could die, who knows how much longer I have, I better get going, I gotta get a shidduch for my son Yitzchak. And that's the whole parsha with sending Eliezer, who eventually comes back with Rivka. And the Torah describes in Perek Chav Dalet, Pasuk Samach Zayin, how they bring back, Eliezer brings back Rivka, Yitzchak and Rivka see each other. Thank God it's love at first sight. And then the Torah tells us, it's this pasuk you don't have on the source sheet, Vivya Yitzchak Ahoala Sara Imo, he brings her, right, she had a tent. What tent did she have? He gives her the tent that previously had been his mother's Sarah. Then the Torah tells us, Vivya, he loved her, V'yenachem Yitzchak Achrei Imo. And he was finally somehow comforted, or consoled, I guess is the better word, for the death of his mother. What is going on here? A lot's going on in one of the pasuk. So Rashi tells us, in source number 15, based on the Medrash, that while Sarah had been alive, there were consistent miracles in her tent. She was such a tzaddikess. Chazal say that she was on a higher level than Avraham. There were three miracles, more even, that were associated with her tent. Says Chazal, says Rashi, those three had ceased after she died. When Yitzchak brings Rivka back and says, here, this will be your room, this is your tent, all of a sudden, the miracles resumed. So in terms of being comforted, he now sees, I found an appropriate match. This is a woman who's on the same Adrega, a tzadekes like my mother was, just like she had these miracles. How poetic it is it that the same miracles, the same bracha, is brought back now by my wife. But what were those three? So look at the Rashi here, source number 15. Shekozman shesara kayemes, when Sarah was alive, hayaner daluk me'erev Shabbos, erev Shabbos. Right, she would light the candles Friday night, and they would stay the whole week until she had to blow them out and light again. That was a miracle, obviously. Even bigger than the Maccabees. Ubracha metzuya ba'isa. There was some bracha, whatever it was, the bounty, it stayed fresh. She would bake. The isa, the dough, would also had supernatural properties. And number three, anan kashur ala ohel. It used to be a special miraculous cloud that was above Sarah's tent. That had gone away, it came back when Rivka comes in. Kishabat Rivka, Chazru, all these miracles are resumed. Okay, those are the three things. So sure enough, both from Rishonim, the Chizkuni, and more after that, the Maharal and Gur Aryeh, source 16 and 17, they both point out, on this week's Parsha, that these three miracles mentioned by Rashi in the Medrash correspond to the three mitzvos that are uniquely connected to women. Look at the Chizkuni, source number 16. Keneged kiyum mitzvahs nida, chala, and hadlaka saner. The Maharal says the same thing. Now, the first two are obvious, right? They're explicit even, right? There was a miracle of Sarah with the candles, corresponds to the mitzvah of Shabbos candles. There was a miracle with chala, with dough, that corresponds to the mitzvah of chala, right? Because she lit the Shabbos candles in the right way, there was a miracle. She did chala the right way, there's a miracle. What's left with is the cloud. In what way does the cloud symbolize Taras HaMishpacha, the proper observance of Nida? So here you have two different, and each one I think very fascinating interpretations. The Chizkuni says something very interesting. Look at this. Ha'anan kashur hu dugmas Nida. The idea of the cloud hovering over the tent, that was because Sarah observed the laws of Nida. That brought that miracle. Why? Sha'inyan shelahem chozer v'shuv posek v'chozer. Right, I think it's very enigmatic, but what I think he's trying to say is, just like kind of clouds come and go, so whether he's referring to specifically biologically, the menses of a woman, right, comes and goes, and or the laws of Taras HaMishpacha, there are times where their husband's allowed to be with his wife, and not, that rhythm of coming and going, stopping and starting, that's symbolized by a cloud. That's the Chizkuni's interesting interpretation. The Maharal in source number 17 says it slightly, and he has a different approach. He says, again, same idea. He says, Anan, Kashur al-Oel, the idea that there was this cloud on the tent. What's that got to do with the laws of Nida? Ki ha-Anan, ha-Kavod, hu shchinas ha-Kavod yizbarach. Right? This was not stam a cloud. This was kind of like the Anan that we describe, you know, leading the Jewish people in the desert. This was a symbol of Hashem's presence over her tent. V'zehu l'chvod ha-kedusha v'tahara. What brings Hashem's presence into a home? What brings Hashem's presence into a tent? That refers to kedusha and tahara. U'lefichach, sara shahaisa shomeres ha-tahara min anidus, zach sashia anan ha-kavod shor ala ohel. So this, I think, you know, again, I think the Chizkuni's idea is very fascinating, although a little enigmatic, but I think the Maharal's idea is particularly beautiful. That the Anan here is not randomly that a cloud, instead of moving, you know, coming and going, the cloud stayed. The cloud was a symbol, not just because it was a miracle, but the cloud itself was somehow an embodiment of Hashem's presence. And what brings Hashem's presence into a family, into a home? Kedusha. And because Sarah was the one who was primarily responsible for the laws of Nida being kept between her and Avram, so that is what brought the Kedusha specifically to her tent. So too, when Rivka resumed, comes, the understanding being that she'd be the type of tzadeket who would have the same level of tzniyus, the same level of Kedusha as her mother-in-law, and therefore also brings them back. So first of all, you have already in primary sources commenting on our Parsha, this connection, surprising connection, between the miracles of Sarah and Rivka and these three mitzvos. But I think the message that I really want to leave you with in particular, as we finish up the next few minutes, comes from perhaps the one who took this most seriously, was the Lubavitcher Rebbe. In some of my own research, I found the source that I have for you in source number 18. But as it so happens, there's somebody who I've never met personally, although we've corresponded a few times by WhatsApp, lives in America, and he listens to, I don't want to be presumptuous, I want to say all, I don't even want to say a lot. Maybe he does, I don't know. But at the very least, he listens to some of my shurim that are online. And he actually listened to last week's shir. And he sent me, I think he's Lubavitch, he sent me a different, very, very long piece of one of the sichas of the Rebbe. And he said, I know you're speaking about the three mitzvahs for women. Well, guess what? In this week's Parsha, the Rebbe has a whole mimer all about Rivka and the three mitzvahs. And I actually read it very late last night. And for those who are interested, I'm happy to send it to you, but it's very, very long. So I just thought it was interesting, and this is not what we're going to be focusing on. Some of you may know the Rebbe and Lubavitch to this day had a huge campaign for single girls, even young girls, to light candles. So I don't know how many times the Rebbe spoke about it, but this is one of those places. Because he's very big. The whole end of the essay is all about you see, you see, you see. And he has proofs about how Rivka, when she was young, she lit candles, and Sarah, when she was young, and how young girls, and that's not the minhag in most families, but that's a big Lubavitch thing. That's also part of the essay. But the part that I found most powerful, and I think because it dovetails, I think it's true, but also dovetails with the point we've been trying to make, is what he says here in source number 18. After summarizing everything else, he says, these three mitzvos, Hein shlosha ha'amudim sh'aleihem mevusasim habayis v'chayei ha'mishpacha ha'yehudiyim. Right? This is the foundation of every Jewish home. You have the physical, the emotional or spiritual, right? The physical being the bread, the spiritual, the candles symbolizing Torah or the neshama. And I would say, personally, that the laws of Taras ha'mishpacha are the fusion of the two. And on the one hand, there's nothing more physical. On the other hand, we know there's something, you know, profoundly, profoundly spiritual, v'hayula basar echad, of the act of creation, potentially, of two people coming to, becoming one together, etc. So there's kedusha and physicality, and the fusion of the two. These are the foundation, says the Rebbe, of every Jewish home, v'chayei ha'mishpacha ha'yudiyim, of every Jewish family. Ha'uvda, sheheim nim saru b'miyuchad li'isha, the fact that these three, which are the foundation of every Jewish home, are specifically given over to the responsibility of women, mochicha, proves ki anka la achrayut bilti regila, that a woman has been bequeathed out of the ordinary, extraordinary responsibility, uzuchut bilti regila bechayim. And of course, corresponding to the responsibility is the zchus, is the tremendous opportunity and privilege that a woman is given. The greatest responsibility and the greatest privilege in all of Jewish life to maintain a Jewish family and a Jewish home is specifically, says the Rebbe, given over to women through these three mitzvos. Lo rak b'yachas l'mishpacha shela. And don't think, I have this hugely important job. My whole family's foundation, spiritually, physically, emotionally, depends on me. It's much bigger than that, says the Rebbe. It's not that just your family and your home is dependent on you. Lo rak, not just in your own unique particular family. Kim gam biyachas lekol am ha'yehudi. The whole Jewish nation is dependent on you. Because the Jewish people, he says, Morkav, is made up of, kamuvan, mesach misach hakol, shel kol mishpacha ha'yehudit. That is to say, every Jewish family is a piece in what makes what is the Jewish people? Lots of Jewish families. So basically, by sustaining a Jewish home and a Jewish family, one is sustained the entire Jewish family and the Jewish people. And I think that this is, to me, really what gets back to the topic we had mentioned last week, but I think it's really, so, so profound. And again, I don't think it's apologetics or modern sensitivities. It may be more emphasized now or maybe articulated in a clearer way now than it may have been, but these are classical sources. These are not new sources. These are not post-feminist movement sources. These are very, very other than the Rebbe, but I don't think he was so impacted by that either, to be honest. But a lot of these are very, very classical sources that the foundation of the Jewish people is the Jewish home. That, I think, is a classic hashkafa, which has nothing to do with women, per se, or men. We believe that the centrality of the Jewish family to Yiddishkeit, I think, is beyond obvious. But the idea that these mitzvos, again, obviously we know life and family life and marital life is much more complicated than just these three mitzvos. These are typologies, these are categories. But the idea that these represent the basic building blocks and foundations of any family, spiritual, religious, physical, emotional, spiritual, the fusion of those, etc. And the fact that those are not only, Not only. The man has got responsibilities too, obviously. But primarily given over as a responsibility to the woman is not only an unbelievable schus, but obviously an unbelievable statement of confidence that the Torah has in women. And this incredible role, I think, is captured in a number of places, including, for example, the very famous phrase of source number 19, where Chazal referred to the term bias, the home, zu ishto, beso zu ishto, right? The Kohen Gadol had to be married. You cannot have a Kohen Gadol who's single. And if Nebuchadnezzar Kohen Gadol got divorced, Kohen Gadol was widowed, then he couldn't be the Kohen Gadol anymore. Because to serve in the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, to do the Avodah, which was the most important thing Kohen Gadol did all year, the Pasuk says, V'kiper ba'ado u'ba'ad beso. He has to get kapara, forgiveness for the whole Jewish people, but also for his family. And says the Gemara, or the Mishnah really here, source number 19, beso zu ishto. Right now, sometimes people quote this and they think it's like this, you know, denigrating term. The women are only for children, or women only can be domesticated. But that's not the context at all. That's totally, totally distortion of the Jewish approach. And I'm not saying you can't find a Gemara somewhere or a Medrash somewhere that's less than flattering. Let's be honest, there are such sources out there. But it's not the mainstream view, it's not the predominant view, even remotely. Right, this in this context and everything we've seen until now, it actually fits perfectly. It's not a random, you know, metaphor for women. Oh, we couldn't think of anything, so we'll call them the house. No, of course, if you see these all the sources we've seen until now, especially the sources on this week's Parsha, it makes perfect sense. There's another Gemara in Moed Katan says, "Ain't ohalo ela ishto." Right, a man's wife is his tent. Same idea, besozo ishto. But it makes perfect sense, especially with these midrashim and the stories about Rivka and Sarah and all these sources that we've seen, including from the most recently from the Rebbe, because the whole foundation of the home and these three pillars are ones that are given over as the responsibility to the woman. So again, I don't think I could say it better. How could I say it better than the Lubavitcher Rebbe? It's an unbelievable achrayus and it's an unbelievable schus. And like lots of responsibilities, there are times it's more fun, and there are times it's less fun. And there are times it's more difficult, and at times it's less difficult. That's true for all of us, in all of our respective responsibilities. I have a newsflash for you. It's not always so great to be a man. There are challenges there, too. I'm not comparing, and I'm not competing. It's not a competition. But each role has its complementary importance and complementary responsibilities. I'll just conclude with something that you probably know, but I'll mention it even without reading it inside. Rabbeinu Bachai, you're talking about right from one of the Rishonim, a Talmud of the Ramban. Source number 20 points out the minhag of davening when you light Shabbos candles, a special prayer, a tchina that women say when they light Shabbos candles, and specifically, what are they getting? Really, you could ask for anything. There's no halacha. You do whatever, you could ask for anything you want during Shabbos candles. And at different stages of life, you might want to ask for different things. But the classical request that we think we pray for during Shabbos candles is for righteous children. And it's not a coincidence, because it all goes back to this same theme. Now, I didn't know it, because I don't bake challah, and obviously I'm not involved in the suffer law. But sure enough, I think, again, I don't know how many people do this, but I Googled with some very, very firm sources last night, and you can find, and probably you all know this better than I do, that many women have special tchinos that they say when they're separating challah. There are all sorts of tchinos and tfilos you can find before you go to mikvah or other such things. And I was reading some of them, and some of them are also very much around this theme. Because these are propitious times. These aren't stam mitzvos. These are mitzvos that really have an opportunity to bring special bracha to your life and a special bracha to the life of your family. And it makes sense that when a person is doing such a special mitzvah anyway, why not, as they might say, chaparain, why not use the opportunity to daven for special things as well? So, these are my thoughts. Sorry we went a little bit long, but I think these were really, really important, and hopefully give you a great appreciation of these mitzvos and your role generally. And you should really be in Shul this Shabbos so you can hear the laning and go see this, and you'll really appreciate the psukim probably more than your husbands do. Okay, have a good day, everybody.